Randall Hyman is in the studio with me today. He's a photojournalist from here in the St. Louis area who has gone on some remarkable adventures over the three decades that he's been behind the camera. And I invited him in here today to talk about one particular adventure he had. If you think it's cold here today, you should hear about where he has been and what he has done. Randall, welcome to the studio.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Randall went to the Arctic, the Norwegian Arctic, with a group of scientists, climatologists and others, who are documenting climate change by taking a look at the Arctic ice, right?
Yeah, that's a pretty good description of what we were up to.
Okay. How do you get to the Arctic Circle?
Well, the Arctic Circle is actually very accessible, especially in Europe. I mean, about half of Norway is above the Arctic Circle. So on the mainland itself, you pass that right away. But the area we were in is way, way, way north. It's at 82 degrees north, which is, you know, about 500 miles from the North Pole. So that's way far into the high north.
Okay. What time of the year did you go?
We went in midsummer, which is a good time to go for a few reasons. That's when we measure the minimum extent of sea ice, and it tells us how quickly the Earth is warming and how quickly the ice is receding. Because in the winter, of course, things refreeze, but it's deceiving. The extent of the ice, the thickness is just as important as the extent. And so in the summer, you can see just how thick and how far north it's retreated.
I mentioned the cold. What are temperatures like 500 miles from the North Pole in summer?
Well, you know, surprisingly, at least in that part of the Arctic, well, I've been in Siberia, too, in the summer. It's not so bad. It's warmer than it is here today in St. Louis. Oh, yeah. I mean, of course, in the winter, we're talking severe temperatures. But in the summer, a good down coat and warm gloves and a good wool hat will get you through the day.
So it's in the 20s, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. In Fahrenheit, between 10 and 20 degrees, yeah.
Yeah. Not horrible?
No.
All right, so you've been going there many times over the course of your career, right?
Yeah, not just the Norwegian Arctic, but Siberia. A lot to Iceland. I speak Icelandic. I've lived there. That's Arctic and subarctic in Iceland. And a lot to Norway also.
And have you been going there to document climate change?
Not initially. I went to Iceland initially, chasing a girl. And that quickly melted.
Having seen some pictures of some Icelandic women, I don't think anybody's going, this guy's crazy.
But after a few years, that became a history.
Yep.
But I had learned.
The ice thawed.
And the ice thawed. And I became very interested in the Icelandic culture. I learned the language. I studied at the university. And I went back many, many times for the Smithsonian Magazine, National Geographic Society, doing various book assignments and magazine assignments. Eventually was lucky enough to be in the middle of a volcanic eruption.
Wow.
In a blizzard at night all by myself. And, you know, one thing led to the other. And I've got to say, as a photographer, the light in the Arctic, the Nordic light is something pristine and special.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about this trip to Norway where you shot the video, which is on Vimeo, by the way, and I've got it on my website, harrisonline.com. It's called Shattered Ice. Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, it was part of a much larger project for the that I happily got grant funding for from the Fulbright Foundation. And it was a large project that was 4 months long, and it was documenting the changes, technological, cultural, scientific changes in the wake of climate change in the Norwegian Arctic, how it's affecting the people, how it's affecting the animals, how it's affecting the land, and also their economy. One of the big surprises for me is that thus far, Norwegians are benefiting from climate change. If you want to look just at the financial side of things, you know, as the sea ice recedes, it opens up that frozen lid to things like oil drilling and natural gas exploitation, mineral resources. The Arctic is very, very rich in resources. Mm-hmm. A third of the untapped natural gas of the world lies beneath the Arctic Ocean.
So as the ice recedes, they have more land and they can exploit that land and the resources underneath the land?
Well, more that they have more sea that they can get to. The land itself is not the big issue. It's the fact that the Arctic is a friendly, the Arctic Ocean is a friendlier place now for humans.
Mm-hmm.
But it can come back to bite us because as climates shift northward, you have the, whatever was in the south. If you have a climate zone that goes north, then the southern part is affected as well. So, for example, the cod fisheries have never been richer right now than they are in the Barents Sea and the Norwegian Sea, which is part of the Arctic Ocean. Well, that's because the waters are moving north. There's currents that are bringing nutrients up from the bottom, from the continental shelf, and the cod fisheries are growing. But to the south, the cod are dwindling, and the fisheries are dwindling.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no... you always have something to pay for any sort of change.
How long before the positive effects that the Norwegians are experiencing now go away?
Well, they're already seeing some negative effects. Underneath the tundra, whether you're in Alaska, Siberia, or Norwegian Arctic, Finland, Sweden in the north, you have something called permafrost. It's a substrate. It's beneath the surface of the ground, which is permanently ice. And we rely on that. If it starts to melt, buildings cave in. I've seen that in Siberia. And the pipeline, our own pipeline from Alaska, can cave in.
It's built on the permafrost.
It's built on permafrost. Mm-hmm. And so as the climate changes and things warm, that's going to be a negative effect. There's a lot of other things that affect us globally. Methane released from the tundra is adding to carbon dioxide. It's kind of a domino effect. It makes already bad situation worse when you get more carbon dioxide in the air, which is a greenhouse gas.
And in fact, I understand from reading some of your work that the iPhones we buy in St. Louis have an effect on the Arctic Circle.
That is a hard concept to get through to people. But, you know, when your laptop dies, it's got to go somewhere. It often ends up in a landfill. And let's just take it very locally and personally. The landfill may be along the Merrimack River, and so it rains, and it rains, and it rains. And the fire retardants used in an iPhone and in a laptop and a computer have a retardant, a fire retardant in it, because these things get super hot. Those fire retardants are a toxin which gets washed into the Merrimack, which goes into the Mississippi, down the Gulf Stream, and boy, the Gulf Stream takes it straight up to the Arctic. And the very cold weather and some... chemical processes that are just an unfortunate quirk of nature trap those toxins right into the marine environment and the land environment, and then it goes up the food chain.
Mm-hmm.
And like we may all remember from junior high or high school or whatever, the whole process of the food chain, it's every step going up is 10 times more concentrated, whatever it is, protein, but also poisons. And so the top predators like polar bears get a very, very high concentration of things like mercury and these toxins that are in your iPhone, and it affects their systems. They've found mixed genitalia in female polar bears. Well, it's because these particular fire retardants are estrogen emulators, and they confuse the hormonal system. And you get really bizarre things happening to animals, and also the mercury is a brain poison, so it can really... kill off seabirds.
Now, let me just stop you right there, because I'm trying to imagine what it's like to have been a scientist who discovered these animals with this problem and then try to figure out what would cause that? And then have to work back to, because of the toxins that are going from our electronics that are getting washed up there with the Gulf Stream. That's remarkable.
Yeah, well, it's not a new phenomenon. There, in the 70s and 80s, we had PCBs.
Mm-hmm.
Which are similar, and we had DDTs, which are not similar, but we already know about how toxins get concentrated in the environment. It affected eagles and their eggs that were too thin to hatch. And so it's not a surprise to scientists anymore to trace things back to toxins that come from far, far away. I mean, you go to the Arctic, and it's pristine. It's beautiful. It appears as clean as anywhere on Earth could possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
But there's these hidden things going on, climate change and toxin poisoning of the Arctic Ocean.
This is the Big 550 KTRS. Paul Harris filling in for Martin Kilcoyne, talking with Randall Hyman, a local photojournalist who's been on remarkable expeditions, and in particular, the one that they turned into about a 13 or 15-minute video called Shattering Ice, which is available on Vimeo right now, V-I-M-E-O. You can find it there online and watch this adventure that he took with these various scientists to shoot under the Arctic ice. Now, it's important for us to point out, you didn't go under the Arctic ice, did you?
I'm a cheater.
You didn't put on a wetsuit and dive in?
No, I'm no fool. I took a painter's pole that could extend 8 feet, and I took every inch of my arm and plunged it down through the breathing hole that seals have in the winter, or in the summer as
well.
Which
is where the divers went in. They opened up that hole.
They opened it up.
As their way to get into the solid ice. How thick is the ice there, by the way?
About 2 meters, 6 feet.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. 6 feet thick, and they drill through it to open up the seal hole,
mm-hmm.
and then you let them go first.
I let them go.
and then you have a camera at the end of a pole.
Yeah.
And you stick it down there, and can you see...
Freeze your arm off.
can you see what the camera is shooting?
No. No. I mean, if I were a TV crew with sophisticated equipment, sure, they have ways of doing that, wireless ways of watching it on a monitor. But no, I was taking a guess. But, you know, when they go under the ice, they've got limited air supply, and they go maybe 100 feet down. And they look up at this ice, this white ceiling above them, and they can't find the hole. It all looks the same, that the hole that came down through. And they're going to be out of air in an hour.
Wait, they can't find the hole? When mm-mm. they look up?
No. No, because you've got this vast expanse of white that goes in all directions.
Mm-hmm.
And they've wandered who knows how far away from that hole.
Right, they haven't gone straight down, so it's not straight above them.
No.
They might be a quarter mile away.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's a tiny little thing in the scheme of things.
Yep.
And they have, because of that, ropes tied to each of them. And they can just follow that cord back to the hole. Well, I use that cord to take a pretty educated guess of where those guys must be diving. And a lot of the times they were near the surface because that's where they were getting samples. That's where a lot of the samples of the small marine organisms are.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we were looking at. We're looking at, believe it or not, the ice itself is a source of life in the Arctic in many, many ways. But in this case, what they were looking at is the microorganisms, the phytoplankton, the zooplankton, which is the beginning of the food chain. And they wanted to find out how healthy is the food chain there
mm-hmm.
where we were. So they were collecting samples, usually right under this frozen lid, right under the ice. And I could take a good guess of where they were, and you'll see that on the video,
mm-hmm.
and see what they were up to, collecting samples and such.
Yeah, they take these plastic containers down there,
mm-hmm.
and they collect some of this, as you say, the very, very bottom of the food chain,
yeah.
and they're collecting that. But from watching the video, I know that in some of the places they went to where they expected to find these things, they weren't there. Had they been there on the previous trip?
Well, yeah. Yes. they had been there... As the ice has seasonally retreated more and more and more farther north toward the North Pole, the time of the year at which they can encounter these life-bearing ice, which it's got ice algae is what the little secret is here,
mm-hmm.
and that moves farther and farther north, and it blooms at a different time of year. It's all about the bloom. And this bloom of algae is critical to the whole food system, the whole ecosystem in the Arctic.
Yep.
Because it moves, it recedes farther and farther. It's like our growing zone on land. You know, the crops start coming to the surface, you know, the little seedlings of corn farther south first. And then as you go farther north in the United States, the corn isn't sprouting until, 3 weeks later. So mm-hmm. the same thing in the Arctic on the ice.
Okay.
But there's actual little fissures in the ice, little tubules in which this algae lives. It's called ice algae.
Okay.
And it's the very base of the food chain.
All right. So they go and they are surprised that it's not where they thought it was because, well, here's where it was last time.
Yeah.
And we figured, okay, well, it would be further north because we knew it's going to be retreated. But they were surprised it wasn't even where they thought it might have retreated to.
They were exasperated, frustrated, and we kept pushing that ship. It had a 9-inch thick reinforced steel bow so we could bash through the ice. And we kept pushing farther and farther north and still no ice algae. And they were very, well, I guess worried is the word because their whole expedition, all their work depended on finding that stuff.
Mm-hmm. So as they're not finding it, and they're getting more and more frustrated, you, the photographer, you're documenting this actually on board the ship,
yeah,
and getting good video of them. But what's going through your mind? Because you're actually there not to do the onboard stuff, but the on-ice stuff.
Well, as a journalist, you record what you're experiencing and what's happening. There's one interview in this Vimeo that you mentioned, in which one of the climatologists, well, he's a sea ecologist, he talks about how a friend of his 15 years earlier had joked that, hey, you know, if this ice keeps melting, you're going to be out of a job.
Yeah.
And he's saying now, wistfully, maybe the guy was right.
How soon?
Well, that's anybody's guess. By the year 2030, the guess is that at least in the summertime, there will be no ice in the Arctic.
No ice in the Arctic?
Well, the Arctic Ocean, yeah, will be ice-free, virtually ice-free. You'll have little blocks of it floating around, but the point is ships will be able to pass through. And that's part of this other story that I was talking about, the economy of Norway and Russia. You know, this recent thing with Russia and the Greenpeacers, the resting the guys on the oil rig. The fact that they were drilling oil there in the Arctic Ocean is all related to this.
Mm-hmm.
And the Russians are very aggressive about making claims in the Arctic Ocean. They planted their flag on the base of the ocean at the North Pole and said, this is ours. And the Canadians said, no, we have underwater mountain ridges that run there. That's ours. And the Americans are saying the same thing. It's a land grab at sea.
Because of the oil.
The oil, and not just oil, there's a lot of ore, a lot of minerals that are to be mined using sophisticated equipment. You know, and right now it sounds outlandish, but it once sounded outlandish that we'd get oil out of tar sands and coal, too, but we're doing that now. So it sounds outlandish to go 2 miles down with some sort of underwater equipment and mine copper or whatever, but as the prices on copper go up, it's not going to sound so crazy.
Was that land grab for those minerals and that oil and the rest of the stuff that is down there at the base of that Arctic Ocean, how long ago was it that that was inaccessible?
Oh, just within the decade.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, sure. Things are changing really fast in the Arctic, and that was really the point of this whole project, this four-month project sponsored by the Fulbright Foundation, that I wanted to document all these changes, how rapidly it's changing. And there's an important point to make. In Norway, no one's debating or arguing about whether there is climate change. That went away long ago. Mm-hmm. They live with it daily. They see it daily, mm-hmm. for better or for worse. And as I mentioned, some of it has been, in the short term, better for them.
And it's not even in a person's lifetime that it took a lifetime to change. They see it season to season, don't they?
Season to season. This year when I was in Svalbard, which is way north, it's an archipelago, a bunch of islands, they have the world's most northerly ski marathon. They almost had to call it off while I was there because right before it, we had above freezing temperatures and the snow was melting way out of season.
Mm-hmm.
Things are changing. It's affecting their tourism. And you ask, well, when will they pay the piper for this? Well, already, if you're in winter tourism, you're paying the piper. It's a shorter winter. It's not a severe winter. It's a longer summer. It's a hotter summer. And I saw all of this during the 4 months because I went there in early April and came back in early August.
So what do you say to the small percentage of people who still deny that humans are responsible for climate change?
You know, I say, look, let's hypothetically say everything's incorrect that the scientists have alleged. Let's say there is no climate change and this is a blip in the radar. If we, based on the claims of the scientists, clean our planet a little bit, clean up the air, clean up the water, and then we find out it was all wrong, is that so bad? I mean, if you got guests coming for the weekend and you clean your bathroom, right? And then they don't show, is a clean toilet so bad?
I like that argument. That's good. There's one other aspect to these trips that you've taken that I want to ask you about. And I mentioned this to you before when you and I talked, that there was another documentary that was made a couple of years ago called Chasing Ice.
Yes.
Which was about another photojournalist who had gone out there to document the changes in the glaciers. And in that, there was footage of he and his crew on board these boats near where the glaciers would be melting. And there's a process called calving,
yes,
which is essentially the end of a glacier cliff falling off and into the ocean. Now, that was going on even before we had climate change. It's just part of the natural process,
precisely,
correct?
Absolutely.
Did you experience that firsthand?
Yes. Amazingly, you know, you don't see them. You hear them constantly, way, miles and miles away. You hear the explosions, like distant thunder.
Explosions?
Yeah, because when these are, you know, building-sized pieces of ice cracking loose and plummeting into the ocean, and they make a lot of noise when they do it.
Mm-hmm.
So one time I was with the scientists during this four-month project, and we took a spin past this long glacial front along the sea, and I thought to myself, you know, I know I'm not going to see it. The chances of seeing one cut loose while you're just right in front of it are slim to nothing. But I said, if it does cut loose, 5 years earlier I had seen one cut loose, and I got some wonderful photos of it with the birds scattering and everything, but I had my camera set on a lower shutter speed. I thought, you know, if I were so lucky as to see this, I want it on a super high shutter speed so I can capture the projectiles of ice spinning off into space, you know, house-sized pieces of ice shooting off in all directions. And so I put it on a 2,000th of a second, look up, and there's this explosion. And the whole front of it, for 4 minutes, just this left, right, and front, cutting loose. It was amazing. In his 30 years, he'd never seen an event like that, which was exciting, but it also makes you wonder, in 30 years, he'd never seen an event like that, now we're seeing it, what's happening?
Mm-hmm. And how big was the portion of the glacier that you were seeing fall into the ocean? Are we talking about something as large as the building that we're in here at Westport Plaza?
Oh, yeah, easily. Way bigger.
The size of the Edward Jones Dome, maybe?
In length, yeah, but not all at one time. But, yeah, about that length. In height, 200 feet tall.
Now, when something like that falls into the ocean, that's that long and that high, and you're in the ocean on a boat, do you think to yourself, this is going to eventually start a wave that's going to come right at me?
I saw the wave immediately, and it kept getting bigger and bigger as more and more ice was coming. And the scientist I was with starts taking pictures. I'm like, hey, I'm the professional. I took my pictures. I'm done. Let's get out of here. I'm like, do you see that wave? Do you see that wave? And he's still taking pictures. I say, look at the wave, and it's coming at us. And he says, oh, and he cuts the engine on, and we zipped out of there in our little Zodiac. And
are you able to outrun the wave?
Yeah, we could. It was big. You know, and then because there was no ice around us where we weren't trapped, and so you just ride up. And that'd be like if a tsunami wave goes underneath you and you're out in the middle of the ocean, you really just feel a swelling of the ocean. And
right.
This was like
it's
that.
Not until the wave actually breaks as
right.
It's coming to land that it causes
exactly.
The problems.
And had we been in an area, which is real common, that was icebound, we would have been in big trouble. It would have flipped our boat.
Wow. Wow. The wave was higher than the top of the boat, even from the crow's nest, perhaps?
Well, this was just a little rubber dinghy.
Oh, you're in a dinghy at
this
point.
Well, it's called a Zodiac, but yeah. And the swell itself was, yeah, it was big.
Wow. Scary, but later on, when you got a chance to look at the pictures, which I'm sure you did all digitally, so you could plug into your laptop and you could look at them, stunning stuff.
Yeah, very exciting.
In addition to the video that you shot, which I mentioned is online, it's called Shattered Ice and is available on Vimeo now, and people can go take a look at that. Have you done an exhibition of your Arctic work?
You know, I gave a lecture at the zoo, a one-day exhibition of 14 photos, which one of which is 2 feet by 4 feet, because I wanted people to see these projectiles of ice spinning through the air.
Yeah,
it was this gorgeous, one-of-a-kind picture of this glacier cutting loose.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, those were on exhibit, and I'm traveling with this show. I'm going to Kansas City Zoo and Minnesota Zoo eventually. Next year will have me, and several other institutions around the United States. And I leave for Norway again in, 3 weeks to an Arctic conference. And we're talking with the embassy in Oslo about possibly putting the show on there.
So you're crazy enough to go back to Norway in the winter.
Yeah, and it's dark. There's no sunrise right now in the north.
How is that in the summer, by the way, when there's virtually no night?
It's
psychologically,
wonderful.
What's that
I
like?
Love it. Some people can't stand it. I really love the constant light. You don't sleep much,
yeah,
but you get a lot done.
I broadcast a radio show from Moscow, which is well up there,
yeah.
Very, very far north as well. And I didn't know that before I went there. And we were there at the end of June on the longest days of the year. And the sun was going down at midnight,
yep.
And coming back up at 2:30 in the morning. Is that what you experienced there in the summer?
Well, actually, as far north as we were, at midnight, the sun is about where we'd see it at 4 in the afternoon, and that's as low as it's going to get, and it starts going back up.
So there's no darkness?
Not even close.
How do you sleep?
I don't have a problem with it. I love it. I work long hours shooting and doing writing and whatnot, and then I'm exhausted, and it doesn't matter if it's 4 in the morning or 2 in the afternoon, I take a 2-hour nap.
When it comes time that you're exhausted, you just lie down, and that's the way to do it. Well, you've had amazing adventures, and I'm really glad to have shared some of them with you here today. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Randall Hyman, a St. Louis-based photojournalist who's traveled the world and documented climate change and much more. I urge you to go on Vimeo, V-I-M-E-O, and take a look for his video on there of his recent adventure in the Norwegian Arctic. Terrific stuff. I'm Paul Harris. This is the Martin Kilcoyne Show on the Big 550 KTRS.